Full Time, Work and the Meaning of Life, by David L. Bonson, Post Hill Press, 2024, 205 pages. Table of Contents. Foreword. Introduction. 1. A Crisis of Despair. 2. The Current Pandemic. 3. Created for What? 4. The Sermon You'll Never Hear. 5. Money and Ambition. 6. The Economic Case. 7. Retirement Disaster. 8. Moving from Half-Time to Full-Time. 9. Pouting Pulpits and Part-Time Pastors. 10. Imbalancing Act. Conclusion. Appendix. A brief book summary from Books at a Glance by Joshua K. Smith. Overview. This book argues that a pervasive sense of despair and unhappiness in modern society stems from a misunderstanding of work's purpose and value. He challenges the prevalent notion that work is merely a means to an end, financial freedom, retirement, etc., instead proposing that work itself is inherently good and deeply connected to human identity and fulfillment. Author. David L. Bonson is a prominent American financial advisor, author, and speaker. He's the founder and managing partner of the Bonson Group, a wealth management firm. Bonson is known for his strong advocacy of free markets and free enterprise, often expressing his views through his weekly podcast, Capital Record, and his writings on economics and finance. He's a frequent guest on various financial news outlets. His work often blends a strong commitment to free market principles with a deeply held Christian faith, integrating his economic and theological perspective in his analyses and arguments. Book Summary. Chapter 1, A Crisis of Despair, Dignity and Earned Success. The rising rates of depression, suicide, substance abuse, and social isolation are not merely individual issues, but symptoms of a deeper cultural problem. This isn't a simple matter of personal failings, but reflects a significant disconnect between individual experience and the perceived meaning of life. This chapter directly contrasts the commonly held notion that work is solely a means to an end, survival, financial security, with a more holistic understanding of work's importance, citing Dorothy Sayers' perspective that work should be a complete expression of the worker's faculties. This sets the stage for his central argument. Work is not merely a means to an end, but is the meaning of life. Evidence of fulfillment in work found in my father's work has deeply shaped my theology of work. This personal experience serves as a springboard to introduce the concept of earned success, emphasizing that the intrinsic satisfaction derived from achieving something through effort transcends mere temporal diversion. This is contrasted with fulfillment with a societal emphasis on medicating through achievement, making a clear distinction between unhealthy coping mechanisms and the restorative power of meaningful work in overcoming trauma. Chapter 2. The Current Pandemic. A Shrinking Workforce Stifles Economic Growth. To address the practical theology of work, one must examine the topic from both a philosophical and economic perspective, and thus examining the serious consequences of declining labor force participation. In this analysis, statistical data showing a significant and sustained drop in participation rates across multiple age groups, pre-prime working age, 16 to 24, prime working age, 25 through 54, and post-prime working age, 55 plus, is examined. One must carefully address potential counterarguments, acknowledging the role of demographics, but emphasizing that these figures are not solely explicable through demographic shifts. The decline in young adult participation is particularly concerning, linked to factors such as increased reliance on student loans for non-tuition expenses and rising minimum wage requirements. The decline in prime working age participation presents a serious economic crisis, as does the unexpected stagnation in older worker participation. Thus, one can directly connect the declining workforce to the significant shortfall in projected GDP growth. That the societal costs of this decline, going beyond mere economic impact, are profound and largely overlooked. In conclusion, by emphasizing the urgent need to address this crisis, framing it not only as an economic problem, but also a reflection of deeper cultural issues. Chapter 3. Created for what? What Genesis really says about work. A proper understanding of work requires a firm grounding in creational theology. There is an emphasis at the beginning of Genesis to understand the theological framework surrounding work and the nature of humanity. The key point is that mankind is explicitly described as very good, a distinction not given to other aspects of God's creation, which underpins the intrinsic value of work, directly linking human dignity to productive activity. The author uses close readings of these texts to counter Gnostic interpretations that see material creation and work as inherently inferior to the spiritual realm, emphasizing the profound harmony between the material and spiritual aspects of human experience. Wealth is defined as productive output, goods and services that meet human needs, rejecting purely materialistic definitions. The theological case is developed further by examining the creation mandate, humanity's role as stewards of creation, and the specific directive for human work in Genesis chapter 2, verse 15. The concept of economic growth is presented not as a secular construct, but as theologically grounded in the mandate for humanity's creation and activity. In summary, by addressing the common misunderstandings of the curse of work in Genesis chapter 3, contextualizing it within the broader redemptive narrative of Christianity, and highlighting the importance of Sabbath rest as a divinely ordained aspect of human experience. Chapter 4. The Sermon You'll Never Hear. The Whole Bible's Message on Work. Many pastors may feel discomfort in openly promoting the inherent goodness and value of work, which suggests this stems from a flawed understanding of the relationship between salvation by grace and human agency in our vocations. The core argument focuses on the Hebrew word avodah, showing its diverse usage in Scripture and its consistent association with both work and worship. This linguistic insight challenges the common separation between sacred and secular, arguing that a true understanding recognizes the intrinsic link between the two. For example, if we examine how Jesus' parables consistently demonstrate the importance of work and its connection to spiritual truths, while analyzing Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10's notion of good works, we see a potential misinterpretation of vocational work. Unfortunately, many churches shy away from a more robust theology of work, suggesting a combination of well-intentioned caution, genuine theological ignorance, and possibly cynical self-interest. The concept of generosity must be examined to challenge the common misinterpretation that views work solely as a means to accumulate resources for giving. Churches must advocate for a bolder, more integrated approach to preaching about work, urging ministers to align their messaging with the full scope of Scripture's teachings on this crucial aspect of human life. Chapter 5. Money and Ambition. Idols or Healthy Motivators. Ethical issues surrounding money and ambition in a Christian context are complex. Any discussion of money quickly creates tensions between cultural norms and God's blessing of wealth and His warnings against materialism. This common yet flawed approach of establishing an arbitrary threshold of acceptable wealth, noting the implicit hypocrisy and self-congratulatory nature of such perspective, must be critiqued. However, a critique doesn't condemn the pursuit of wealth, but rather the underlying worldview that views wealth accumulation as a primary metric of moral righteousness. Biblical clarity is of the utmost importance in this discussion. One must highlight both the positive and negative aspects of wealth to demonstrate the need for a balanced approach. From here, a discussion must move to a more nuanced examination of vocational ambition, using the corner office scenario to illustrate the difficulties in setting clear boundaries between ambition and idolatry. There's a pervasive false dichotomy between career and family, often neglecting that a healthy approach needs to acknowledge and integrate both into a life of purpose and service. The conclusion reiterates the need to avoid both extremes, idolatry and self-deprecating renunciation of financial success, advocating instead for a more integrated and nuanced perspective on money and ambition that aligns with a biblical worldview. Chapter 6. The Economic Case. We produce, therefore we are. There are many misunderstandings surrounding work that stem from flawed economic reasoning. The reader must note two competing economic visions: the classical emphasis on production versus the Keynesian focus on consumption. Say's law, supply creates its own demand, underscores the centrality of production in driving economic activity. Contrasting this with Keynesian economics, the reader can connect macroeconomic principles to individual behavior, discussing the interplay of material and immaterial inputs in the production process. The dignity of work, drawing upon thinkers like Aristotle and Augustine, emphasizes the timeless and universal importance of productive activity. Chapter 7. Retirement Disaster. Rethinking the idea of a 30-year vacation. This chapter challenges the prevailing societal view of retirement as a prolonged period of leisure, which begins by analyzing the marketing messages surrounding retirement, critiquing their portrayal of retirement as a prolonged vacation, and highlighting the underlying assumption that work is primarily a means to an end. Prolonged life expectancy led to the Great Enrichment, or modern retirement. However, the current vision of retirement is economically and socially unsustainable. The negative impacts of widespread retirement are seen in the loss of productivity, mentorship, and the significant societal contributions of experienced workers. One ought to reject the equation of financial freedom with freedom from work, advocating instead for a more integrated approach to retirement that involves continued meaningful engagement and service. The central argument here is that the dominant view of retirement is rooted in a lack of gratitude for the unprecedented prosperity and longevity afforded by modern society, leading to a distorted perception of work and discouragement of continued productive contribution in later life. Chapter 8. Moving from half-time to full-time. Success and significance are not at odds. This chapter offers a critical examination of Bob Buford's half-time model, highlighting both points of agreement and disagreement. While appreciating Buford's intention to promote a transition from career-focused success to service-oriented significance in later life, the model suffers from a fundamental flaw: the creation of a false dichotomy between success and significance. The underlying assumption is that the first half of life is inevitably characterized by self-serving ambition, contrasting this with the biblical view of work as inherently purposeful and significant. It is also necessary to highlight the subtle Gnostic tendencies in Buford's approach, noting the flawed separation of the sacred and secular. A more holistic view of work and significance is needed, one that allows for a full-time commitment to work and service throughout life. The chapter concludes by using the example of Viktor Frankl to illustrate the enduring value of productive work in all stages of life. Chapter 9. Pouting Pulpits and Part-Time Pastors. Projection over Proclamation. There are several reasons why the local church has an inadequate and sometimes defensive approach to work. First, the well-meaning but misguided caution of pastors worried about potentially negative reactions to a robust pro-work message. Second, the lingering influence of theological errors, particularly Gnosticism and Pietism, leading to a distorted view of work's purpose. Third, the potential for cynical self-interest in churches that downplay the importance of work to avoid conflicts with their congregants' views. There is a growing presence of non-church philanthropic organizations, and their influence shapes the church's perspective on work. Pastors should begin modeling a strong work ethic and preaching a robust theology of work, using the example of the Apostle Paul to illustrate the importance of a strong work ethic for Christian leaders. Chapter 10. Imbalancing Act. Our obsession with work-life balance. Is there such a thing as work-life balance? This popular concept is misleading and ultimately harmful in the believer's approach to life. Believers should critique the underlying assumption about the notion of balancing work and one's personal life. Is it possible to compartmentalize such? Pursuit of balance often leads to devaluation of work and a neglect of other important aspects of life, presenting a distorted and ultimately unbiblical view of human purpose and flourishing. Such a concept as work-life balance led to a form of dualism, arguing it inappropriately separates work from other vital areas of life. Instead of seeking artificial balance, believers need to emphasize the importance of the work-rest paradigm found in Scripture and the need for wisdom, discernment, and intentionality in managing life's various demands. Conclusion. The conclusion summarizes the book's key themes, reaffirming the centrality of work to human flourishing and challenging the prevalent misunderstandings surrounding work's purpose, value, and place in a Christian worldview. There's a crucial need to integrate work and other vital aspects of life, emphasizing the importance of fulfilling God's creation mandate through productive and purposeful work. Appendix. The appendix analyzes the work-from-home trend, critiquing its negative impacts on productivity, mentorship, and community, arguing it reflects a diminished understanding of work's importance and advocating for a return to more traditional workplace settings. Copyright 2025, Books at a Glance. Books at a Glance book summaries are available by subscription only, and except for brief quotes, may not be reproduced in whole or in part without express written permission.